I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Though Philadelphia's controversial sweetened beverage tax is on the books and is being collected, critics and proponents are still spending millions of dollars on ads to convince the public it's a good or bad idea. WHYY's Dave Davies reports.
Though the tax was enacted in June of last year, the warring parties have spent more than $5 million this year on ads touting or condemning the penny-and-a-half-per-ounce levy on sweetened beverages. This Axe the Bev Tax Coalition ad features a soda sales rep and a hoagie shop owner.
Before the tax, everything was fine. We were making ends meet. But as of right now, with the beverage tax, it's just killing the city.
I don't think it's fair to our customers. We try to offer the best food at the best price. And with that tax, the workman can't afford it anymore.
The ads are funded by the American Beverage Association, which is also the lead plaintiff in a lawsuit challenging the tax. It's now before the state Supreme Court. Axe the Tax spokesman Anthony Campisi says the ads are important, even though the tax is established law.
We're hoping that at some point we can get this tax to go away. And that could be the legal strategy that we're pursuing. That could be legislation in the future. But the only way you get there is by making it very clear to the public and to our elected representatives that this tax is bad public policy.
Pro-beverage tax ads began appearing in the spring and summer.
This September, kids who couldn't afford pre-K before will walk into classrooms all over Philadelphia, joining the many who graduated in June, thanks to the soda tax.
Kevin Feely is spokesman for the group Philadelphians for a Fair Future.
Our activities have been really mostly in response to the continuing onslaught of public communications that you see from the anti-beverage tax folks from the soda industry.
Last year, the group got funding from a variety of sources to promote passage of the tax. All of the pro-soda tax ads in Philadelphia this year are paid for by former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who's also spending big to support a soda tax in Cook County, Illinois. And if you took all the money spent on ads for and against the tax and instead spent them on expanding pre-K in Philadelphia, one of the main uses for the beverage tax, it would pay for nearly 600 more kids. The city's subsidizing about 2,000 seats right now. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
The federal corruption trial of U.S. Senator Bob Menendez is now in its fourth week. The New Jersey Democrat and one of his friends are each facing around a dozen counts of bribery, conspiracy, and fraud. Recent testimony has covered the nitty-gritty of what prosecutors say was a scheme to trade lavish gifts for political favors. WHYY's Joe Hernandez was in court in Newark today. And Joe, as it's been about a month since the trial started, some of our listeners may not recall the allegations. What are Menendez and his friend accused of?
Right. So the defendants in this case are U.S. Senator Bob Menendez, a Democrat, and his friend, wealthy Florida ophthalmologist Salomon Melgen. Now, the indictment in this case outlines a long list of political favors that were exchanged for lavish gifts. That's what prosecutors say. They say Menendez helped Melgen get visas for friends, helped him sort out a Medicare billing dispute, and in return, Melgen gave Menendez trips and flights on his private jet. Defense attorneys say these two men are simply longtime friends. Friends, and that Menendez did what he would do for any other constituent when he helped out Melgen.
Of course, the prosecution is still laying out its case against Menendez and Melgen. Who have they called to prove the bribery allegations?
They called one of the pilots on Melgen's private jet, which Menendez flew on back and forth to the Dominican Republic, where Melgen lives. Today in court, a Commerce Department official, Scott Smith, was on the stand for cross-examination. He detailed a meeting he had in 2012 with an attorney who was close to Melgen. At this time, Melgen was trying to sort out a port contract dispute that he had going on in the Dominican Republic, and Smith said that the attorney in this meeting threatened the department and suggested that he had powerful friends, and Smith took that to mean Menendez. Then a guy named Mark Wells took the stand. He works for the State Department, and they also got involved in this port contract dispute in the Dominican Republic. Wells said that he was in some meetings, including one with Menendez, where Menendez said he would call a hearing if this didn't get sorted out, and Wells found that to be unusual, although he said it is part of a congressman or a senator's duty to question what the executive branch is doing with the money that's appropriated by Congress.
Joe, perhaps the most interesting thing to happen around the Menendez trial took place out of state. How does the ruling in the case of New York politician Dean Skelos tie in?
Right. So on Tuesday, a New York appeals court threw out the 2015 conviction of former New York State Senate leader Dean Skelos. He's a Republican. Prosecutors had alleged that Skelos had pressed companies that needed his political backing into funneling more than $300,000 in work and payments to his son. The judge cited a 2016 U.S. Supreme Court ruling in the case of former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell. It narrowed the definition of what's called an official act, which means, for example, if a senator casts a vote in favor of a bill. But doing things like making phone calls or setting up meetings are not really considered official acts anymore. And so bribery cases in that way will be harder to try. Menendez's defense team tried to invoke the McDonnell decision to have his case thrown out. But Judge William Walls said he wanted to wait until he heard the prosecution's case to decide on that motion.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Dave.
WHYY New Jersey correspondent Joe Hernandez on Newsworks Tonight. For the first time in its history, the city of Philadelphia has officially dedicated a public statue to an African American. Earlier today, a permanent sculpture was unveiled at Market and South Broad Streets, honoring Octavius Caddo. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the relatively little-known activist from the mid-19th century accomplished tremendous things in his short life.
He fought for the rights of African Americans to ride Philadelphia's trolley cars. He was an officer in the Civil War. He was a college graduate when many black Americans were still enslaved. And he was a baseball player, a very good one. Ultimately, he was a martyr. On Election Day in 1871, he was shot to death on South Street. He was on the street urging African Americans to exercise their new right to vote. The city shut down a portion of Market Street at South Broad to accommodate the choir from St. Thomas Church and thousands of onlookers as a sculpture dedicated to Octavius Caddo was unveiled.
Monuments are not neutral, passive, or accidental. They carry great meaning.
V. Chapman Smith with the Octavius Caddo Memorial Fund said he was a scholar and a soldier committed to social justice.
Caddo's life and legacy tells us how our young people and community are critical to affecting social change.
Unlike many of the city's other sculptures of heroes and founding fathers, Caddo was shown as a young man, posed with his chest thrust forward, hands outstretched, as though he were about to stride down Broad Street with steely determination. The artist, Branley Cadet, said the sculpture is as much about the future as the past.
May the unveiling of this memorial herald a new era of celebration, herald a new era of acknowledgement and understanding, and herald a new era of deep and lasting healing.
The sculpture was spearheaded in part by Mayor Jim Kenney, who began pushing for it 15 years ago when he was still a councilman, as a reminder of basic civic values.
As well as the inspiration he provides all of us today as we confront a mean-spirited ugliness and intolerance emanating from our nation's capital.
The Octavius Caddo Memorial Fund will not dissolve now that the statue is erected. Its president said the fund will develop educational programs to teach histories of other little-known civil rights heroes. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Through the practice of civil asset forfeiture, Philadelphia law enforcement officials have seized, retained, and sold millions of dollars of property they believe is connected to a crime, even if they know that its owners have done nothing wrong. What is known about the process has come under scrutiny for years and is getting a new look from Philadelphia Weekly reporter Max Marin and Ryan Briggs of City and State, Pennsylvania. Their collaboration is detailed in a report entitled Uncovering Philly Law Enforcement's Secret Bank Accounts. Max, Ryan, thanks for joining me on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having us, Dave.
That this article is entitled Secret Bank Accounts implies that it's a rather opaque process to try to uncover these details.
The article was the product of several months of public records requests trying to obtain previously unreleased financial documents that outline what the police and the district attorney do with millions of dollars that they seize from individuals who are suspected of a crime.
And Max, it's cash. It's cars, it's homes.
It could be the watch off your hand. If you're suspected of participating in a narcotics interaction, law enforcement can technically take it from you and what's called seizing that asset, and then later on, through a complex litigation process, forfeit it and take it into their own bank accounts, which are not available to the public.
And those assets are usually liquidated. So if it's a house, if it's a car, if it's a watch, let's say, those assets would be sold at auction. The money would go into a kind of black budget that, until this article, you know, it was unclear what they were actually doing with this money. And it's a significant amount of money. It's millions of dollars.
Are there, in the course of your work, advocates or proponents of the status quo that you encountered?
Some of the former staffers at the district attorney's office will defend the practice of asset forfeiture. They say that it allows law enforcement to quickly shut down, say, a drug house by seizing the property, taking possession of it, sealing the house. It allows them to get, you know, street money, as they'll say, off of the street quickly and, you know, out of the hands of drug dealers. But in general, I don't know that either of us ever heard a particular defense of why the proceeds had to be so secretive and so opaque.
Now let's fold in efforts in terms of a class action lawsuit to penetrate this
scheme.
Yes,
that is a class action lawsuit that was filed by a libertarian legal aid society, and they represent innocent people whose homes were taken in some cases. A gentleman that we interviewed who was party to the class action lawsuit lost his car and several hundred dollars worth of cash. These are all people who were never convicted of a crime, but merely suspected of some sort of criminal activity. As a part of that lawsuit, the city has made some overtures to radically restructure its forfeiture programs as a kind of compromise.
The offer from the city is to spend this money that they seize through asset forfeiture on drug rehabilitation programs. Right now, and the DA's office admits this in its own reports, they spend virtually no money every year on crime and drug prevention.
What is the money spent on now?
There are thousands of expenses in here. It's millions and millions of dollars. The best way to characterize a lot of it is that it's expenses that the department doesn't really want to other people to know about. Yeah, part of what we found is that a fair amount of the money that the DA reported to us ironically goes back just to operating the forfeiture program. So it pays for DA salaries. It pays for the cost of maintaining the properties that they seize. It pays for the cost of auctioning. So there's a sort of like a loop of dollars.
What of efforts from the legislature, specifically Daylen Leach, to try to rein in some aspects of this practice?
Yeah, Senator Leach and other legislators in Pennsylvania have made some efforts to reform civil asset forfeiture, mostly looking at toughening the standard for a forfeiture action, which at this point, again, merely the suspicion of criminal activity and not a conviction is,
let alone often, a charge.
Right, is often enough to justify a forfeiture action. The legislation that was introduced last year would have changed that. They would have toughened the standard, but ultimately that was watered down after political lobbying from the Pennsylvania Association of District Attorneys.
And we have a district attorney's race coming up right now. This is the first time in I think history that this issue has been part of the campaign trail's talking points. We have Larry Krasner and Republican Beth Grossman talking about their stances on civil asset forfeiture. People are actually asking about this for the first time.
Max Maron, Ryan Briggs, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Hey, happy to be here.
Thanks, Dave.
Philadelphia Weekly reporter Max Maron, Ryan Briggs of City and State, Pennsylvania. Their collaboration is out in a report entitled Uncovering Philly Law Enforcement's Secret Bank Accounts. A new documentary looks at the digital divide among public schools, those that have access to computers and the internet, and those that don't. The film premieres this evening on the National Geographic Channel. At the heart of the documentary, a family in a Delaware County school district which struggles to find enough textbooks and seats for students, much less technology. For WHYY, Sarah Hoover reports.
When Rory Kennedy, the director and producer of Without a Net, The Digital Divide in America, tells people about the project, they figure she's talking about another country.
Say, oh, you must be doing that film in Africa or in South America. And I say, no, this is happening right here in our backyard. It's a far-reaching problem that we really need to get a handle on.
Kennedy was nominated for an Academy Award for her documentary, Last Days in Vietnam. In Without a Net, she spends a fair amount of time on Jamira Miller. She was a senior at Penwood High School in Delaware County during the filming. Miller has seen firsthand the disparity, having attended the more affluent Upper Moreland School District in Montgomery County for 2 years.
What I want from high school is just an opportunity to get a good education so that I can go to college.
Miller's parents are part of the lawsuit against the Pennsylvania Department of Education seeking equity in school funding. Almost every state, more than 40, are part of school finance lawsuits, according to the film. The Miller's experience in the William Penn School District is juxtaposed with Lower Merion School District, located just 5 miles away. Lower Merion is one of the wealthiest school districts in the Philadelphia region. Lower Merion High School is fully equipped with a robotics lab, 3D printers, and offers engineering, robotics, and architecture courses. In the film, two students wonder what it would be like to go to a different school.
If I were to imagine a school with no technology, I would, that'd be very, a very difficult education.
We'd have a completely different life than we'd have completely different aspirations and dreams than we have now, because our hopes for the future are very technology dependent.
Verizon, which co-produced the film, approached Kennedy about making the hour-long documentary. The Millers watched a final version as a family, including Jamira and her siblings.
I was really happy. They really explained things really well. For people who, don't have any background knowledge about the situation, and, anyone can understand what's going on in our school and our nation and, how schools are funded. It talks about the importance of technology. Some schools will have, laptops, but they don't have internet.
Other school districts profiled were from Allegheny County in western Pennsylvania, New York City, and rural areas of eastern Kentucky, Alabama, and Coachella Valley in California. Jamira's mother, Jamela, hopes the film persuades the audience to act.
One of the main things that I will pull out the film is a call to action to our communities, just to say, America is failing. We're failing our students. And if we do not do something, if we do not force legislation, we're going to continue to be behind. We will not be able to compete globally.
Jamela and her husband, Bryant, both from West Philadelphia, grew up in the Philadelphia School District. But Jamela says the technology now is the same as back when they were in school.
I think we thought it was different now. I think we thought our nation had got into a place where it was better, and it was no, it's worse. So it's at what point are we going to come into the century that we're actually in?
Her daughter Jamira remained driven to succeed despite needing blankets in the winter when uninsulated classrooms were so cold it was hard to pay attention. She spent her lunch period in the computer lab doing supplemental work. Miller is now studying at Villanova University on a full scholarship. The 18-year-old says she realizes closing the digital divide will take time, but hopes it changes in time for her siblings.
I hope that my brother and sister would have an opportunity to get the better funding so that our school districts could afford more technology, could afford to just fix basic rudimentary things like if you've seen the hole in the side of the building, just fix basic things such as that.
The documentary is a special selection at the New York Film Festival next week. For WHYY News, Sarah Hoover.
Also on TV this week, WHYY continues airing Ken Burns and Lynn Novick's 10-part documentary, The Vietnam War. In the 1960s and 70s, Philadelphia emerged as one of the hotbeds of the anti-war movement. Thousands of protesters took to the streets, and some took their activism a step further. WHYY's Annette John Hall spoke to members of one group whose action changed the course of America's most powerful law enforcement agency.
It was Bonnie Raine's job to case the joint. Her target, the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania. The young mother tucked her long brown hair under a knit cap and posed as a nearby college student doing research.
I don't think I was scared. I think a little bit of an actress came out in me at that time.
Raines kept a mental checklist, where the doors were, how many locks, and the number of windows.
I think I realized that I had a significant small role to play that was going to lead to our success, and I was into that role.
Here was the plan. Raines and seven other activists, including her husband John, would break into the FBI office, steal key files, and send them to the press. They wanted to expose J. Edgar Hoover's secret surveillance of groups demonstrating against the war in Vietnam. John and Bonnie Raines had been protesting the war since 1966, but it wasn't doing any good.
It became clear that just marching was not going to do it.
By 1969, President Richard Nixon had escalated the war, not ended it.
I became convinced, and others became convinced, that we needed to move from nonviolent protest to nonviolent disruption.
And that's what they did on the night of March 8, 1971, the night most Americans were glued to their radios, listening to the heavyweight bout between Muhammad Ali and Philly's own Joe Frazier.
And now we're ready. Hundreds of millions are seeing this bout around the world, a packed house at Madison Square Garden.
Keith Forsyth was just days shy of his 21st birthday. He was the one who picked the lock to the office, only to discover a file cabinet blocking the entry. He used a jack to pry it away.
It probably didn't take that long, really, but it seemed like a really, really long time to me. Because if somebody comes along, they like, why are you laying on the floor of the hall outside the FBI office with a jack pillar in your hands?
They did find what they were looking for. A treasure trove of documents, including one exposing COINTELPRO, the FBI's illegal counterintelligence operation. They sent the documents to reporters, including Betty Metzger, who wrote a front-page story for The Washington Post. Hoover was furious. He sent out 200 agents to find the culprits and charge them with treason. The whole time, Forsyth says, the burglars were hiding in plain sight in Philadelphia.
Peace movement was not, you know, seven people in a room someplace. It was thousands and thousands and thousands of people just in Philadelphia. So there was an awful lot of suspects.
But none of them were ever caught. And the group never talked about it until one fateful dinner party 43 years later. That's when John Raines let it slip to Metzger that he was one of the burglars. In 2014, she published a book about the crime, and suddenly the world knew their secret.
Thank goodness we did what we had to do, and even more thank goodness, they never caught us.
The couple had taken a huge risk. They had three children under 10 at the time. But it's a risk John and Bonnie Raines say they would take again. The burglary ultimately led to congressional hearings and changes to the FBI's policies on surveillance and phone tapping. Now Bonnie Raines is encouraging this generation to take action under a Trump administration she says is repressive.
We need whistleblowers. We were whistleblowers back then. There are opportunities out there for other individuals to be whistleblowers because there's so much that is going on now that is nefarious and illegal and undermining our Constitution.
John Raines says the stakes may have been high, but their actions paid off.
Looking back on that from 40 or 50 years later, we discover that, in fact, being on the streets finally won the future.
Annette John Hall, Keystone Crossroads.
The Vietnam War documentary continues tonight at 8 on WHYY-TV. It's also available on demand. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.